one got through. Wouldn't you know it took out the Starbucks where we'd hung out during our pre-war training. That's low hitting a coffee place. It could have been worse, I guess. It could have been a Dunkin' Donuts. The joke was that President Bush only declared war when the Starbucks was hit. You can mess with the UN all you want, but when you start interfering with the right to get caffeinated, someone has to pay. We stayed for 3 or 4 days, grousing and depressed the whole time. And finally, we joined the Marine push in the area of Nasiriya. We were back in the war. Near Nasiriya. Nasiriya is a city on the Euphrates River in southern Iraq, about 125 miles northwest of Kuwait. The city itself was taken by the Marines on March 31, but action in the area continued for quite some time, as small groups of Iraqi soldiers and fedayeen continued to resist and attack Americans. It was near Nasiriya that Jessica Lynch was captured and held during the first few days of the war. Some historians believe that the fighting in the area was the fiercest the Marines encountered during the war, comparing it with the most ferocious firefights in Vietnam and later in Fallujah. Besides the city itself, the Marines took Jalaba Airfield, several bridges over the Euphrates, and highways and towns that secured the passage to Baghdad during the early stages of the war. Along the way, they began encountering the sort of fanatical insurgency that would characterize the war after Baghdad fell. We had an extremely small part in the conflict there. We got into some very intense battles, but the bulk of the action was by the Marines. Obviously, I can't write about most of it. What I saw of the overall battle was like looking at an enormous landscape painting through a tiny straw. When you're working with Army and Marine Corps units, you immediately notice a difference. The Army is pretty tough, but their performance can depend on the individual unit. Some are excellent, filled with hoorah and first-class warriors. A few are absolutely horrible. Most are somewhere in between. In my experience, Marines are gung-ho no matter what. They will all fight to the death. Every one of them just wants to get out there and kill. They are badass, hard-charging mothers. We inserted into the desert in the middle of the night, with 2 3-seat DPVs driving off the back of a 53. The ground was firm enough that no one got stuck. We were behind the tip of the U.S. advance, and there were no enemy units in the area. We drove up through the desert until we came to an Army base camp. We rested a few hours with them, then took off to scout for the Marines ahead of their advance. The desert wasn't entirely empty. While there were long stretches of wilderness, there were also towns and very small settlements strung out in the distance. We mostly skirted the towns, observing them from the distance. Our job was to get an idea of where the enemy strong points were, radioing them back so the Marines could decide whether to attack or bypass them. Every so often, we'd reach high ground, stop for a while, and take a scan. We had only one significant contact that day. We were skirting by a city. We obviously got too close because they started engaging us. I fired the 50 cal, then swung around to the 60 as we hauled ass out of there. We must have traveled hundreds of miles that day. We lay up for a while in late afternoon, got some rest, then took off again after nightfall. When we started attracting fire that night, our orders were changed. The headshed called us back and arranged for the helicopters to come back and pick us up. You might think that our job was to attract fire since that revealed where the enemy was. You might think that the fact that we were close enough to get the enemy to fire meant we had discovered a significant force that was previously unknown. You might think that meant we were doing well. You might be right. But to our CO, it was all wrong. He wanted us not to get contacted. He didn't want to risk any casualties, even if that meant we couldn't do our mission properly. And I should add that despite the gunfire and the earlier contact, we had not taken any casualties. We were pissed. We went out expecting to be scouting for a week. We had plenty of fuel, water, and food, and had already figured out how to get resupplied if we needed to. Hell, we could have gone all the way to Baghdad, which at the moment was still in Iraqi hands. We reported back to base, dejected. That wasn't the end of the war for us, but it was a bad sign of what lay ahead. You have to understand, no SEAL wants to die. The purpose of war, as Patton put it, is to make the other dumb bastard die. But we also want to fight. Part of it is personal. It's the same way for athletes. An athlete wants to be in a big game, wants to compete on the field or in the ring. But another part, a bigger part, I think, is patriotism. It's the sort of thing that, if it has to be explained, you're not going to understand. But maybe this will help. One night, a little later on, we were in an exhausting firefight. 10 of us spent roughly 48 hours in the second story of an old abandoned brick building, fighting in 100-degree-plus heat wearing full armor. Bullets flew in, demolishing the walls around us practically nonstop. The only break we took was to reload. Finally, as the sun came up in the morning, the sound of gunfire and bullets hitting bricks stopped. The fight was over. It became eerily quiet. When the Marines came in to relieve us, they found every man in the room either slumped against a wall or collapsed on the floor, dressing wounds or just soaking in the situation. One of the Marines outside took an American flag and hoisted it over the position. Someone else played the national anthem. I have no idea where the music came from, but the symbolism and the way it spoke to the soul was overwhelming. It remains one of my most powerful memories. Every battle-weary man rose, went to the window, and saluted. The words of the music echoed in each of us as we watched the stars and stripes wave literally in dawn's early light. The reminder of what we were fighting for caused tears, as well as blood and sweat, to run freely from all of us. I've lived the literal meaning of the land of the free and the home of the brave. It's not corny for me. I feel it in my heart. I feel it in my chest. Even at a ball game when someone talks during the anthem or doesn't take off his hat, it pisses me off. I'm not one to be quiet about it either. For myself and the SEALs I was with, patriotism and getting into the heat of the battle were deeply connected. But how much a unit like ours can fight depends a lot on leadership. Much of it is up to the headshed, the officers who lead us. SEAL officers are a real mix. Some are good, some are bad, and some are just pussies. Oh, they may be tough individuals, but it takes more than personal toughness to be good leaders. The methods and goals have to contribute to the toughness. Our top command wanted us to achieve 100% success and to do it with zero casualties. That may sound admirable. Who doesn't want to succeed and who wants anyone to get hurt? But in war, those are incompatible and unrealistic. If 100% success, zero casualties are your goal, you're going to conduct very few operations. You will never take any risks, realistic or otherwise. Ideally, we could have done sniper overwatches and undertaken scouting missions for the Marines all around Nasiriyah. We could have been a much bigger part of the Marines' drive. We might have saved some of their lives. We wanted to go out at night and hit the next big city or town the Marine Corps was going to pass through. We'd soften the target for them, killing off as many bad guys as we could. We did do a few missions like that, but it was certainly a lot less than we could have done. Evil. I had never known that much about Islam. Raised as a Christian, obviously I knew there had been religious conflicts for centuries. I knew about the Crusades, and I knew that there had been fighting and atrocities forever. But I also knew that Christianity had evolved from the Middle Ages. We don't kill people because they're a different religion. The people we were fighting in Iraq, after Saddam's army fled or was defeated, were fanatics. They hated us because we weren't Muslim. They wanted to kill us, even though we'd just booted out their dictator, because we practiced a different religion than they did. Isn't religion supposed to teach tolerance? People say you have to distance yourself from your enemy to kill him. If that's true in Iraq, the insurgents made it really easy. The fanatics we fought valued nothing but their twisted interpretation of religion. And half the time they just claimed they valued their religion. Most didn't even pray. Quite a number were drugged up so they could fight us. Many of the insurgents were cowards. They routinely used drugs to stoke their courage. Without them, alone, they were nothing. I have a tape somewhere showing a father and a girl in a house that was being searched. They were downstairs. For some reason, a flashbang went off upstairs. On the video, the father hides behind the girl, afraid that he's going to be killed and ready to sacrifice his daughter. Hidden bodies. They may have been cowards, but they could certainly kill people. The insurgents didn't worry about ROEs or court-martials. If they had the advantage, they would kill any Westerner they could find, whether they were soldiers or not. One day we were sent to a house where we had heard there might be U.S. prisoners. We didn't find anyone in the building. But in the basement, there were obvious signs that the dirt had been disturbed. So we set up lights and started digging. It wasn't long before I saw a pants leg, then a body, freshly buried. An American soldier, Army. Next to him was another, then another man, this one wearing Marine camis. My brother had joined the Marines a little before 9/11. I hadn't heard from him, and I thought that he had deployed to Iraq. For some reason, as I helped pull the dead body up, I was sure it was my brother. It wasn't. I said a silent prayer, and we kept digging. Another body, another Marine. I bent over and forced myself to look. Not him. But now, with each man we pulled out of that grave, and there were a bunch, I was more and more convinced I was going to see my brother. My stomach tightened. I kept digging. I wanted to puke. Finally, we were done. He wasn't there. I felt a moment of relief, even elation. None of them were my brother. Then I felt tremendous sadness for the murdered young men whose bodies we had pulled out. When I finally heard from my brother, I found out that even though he was in Iraq, he hadn't been anywhere near where I'd seen those bodies. He'd had his own scares and hard times, I'm sure, but hearing his voice just made me feel a lot better. I was still Big Brother, hoping to protect him. Hell, he didn't need me to watch over him. He was a Marine, and a tough one. But somehow, those old instincts never go away. At another location, we found barrels of chemical material that was intended for use as biochemical weapons. Everyone talks about there being no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but they seem to be referring to completed nuclear bombs, not the many deadly chemical weapons or precursors that Saddam had stockpiled. Maybe the reason is that the writing on the barrel showed that the chemicals came from France and Germany, our supposed Western allies. The thing I always wonder about is how much Saddam was able to hide before we actually invaded. We'd given so much warning before we came in that he surely had time to move and bury tons of material. Where it went, where it will turn up, what it will poison, I think those are pretty good questions that have never been answered. One day we saw some things in the desert and we thought they were buried IEDs. We called the bomb disposal people and they came out. Lo and behold, what they found wasn't a bomb. It was an airplane. Saddam had buried a bunch of his fighters in the desert. He had them covered with plastic and then tried to hide them. Probably he figured we'd come through like we did in Desert Storm, hit quick and then leave. He was wrong about that. We're going to die. We continued working with the Marines as they marched north. Our missions would typically take us out ahead of their advance, scouting for knots of defenders. Although we had intel that there were some enemy soldiers in the area, there weren't supposed to be any large units. By this time, we were working with the entire platoon, all 16 of us. We came up to a small building compound at the edge of town. Once we were there, we began taking fire. The firefight quickly ratcheted up, and within a few minutes we realized we were surrounded, our escape cut off by a force of several hundred Iraqis. I started killing a lot of Iraqis. We all were. But for everyone we shot, four or five seemed to materialize to take their place. This went on for hours, with the fighting stoking up, then dying down. Most firefights in Iraq were sporadic. They seemed to be very intense for a few minutes, perhaps even an hour or more, but eventually the Iraqis would withdraw. or we would. That didn't happen here. The fight continued in waves all through the night. The Iraqis knew they had us outnumbered and surrounded, and they weren't quitting. Little by little, they started getting closer and closer until it became obvious that they were going to overrun us. We were done. We were going to die. Or worse, we'd be captured and made prisoners. I thought about my family and how horrible that would all be. I determined I was dying first. I fired off more of my rounds, but now a transmission. We're coming up on your six. Friendlies were approaching our position. The cavalry. The Marines, actually. We weren't going to die. Not in 5 minutes, anyway. Thank God. Out of the fight. That action turned out to be our last significant encounter during that deployment. The CO pulled us back to base. It was a waste. The Marines were going into Nasiriyah every night, trying to clear the place out as the insurgency stoked up. They could have given us our own section that we could patrol. We could have rolled in and taken out the bad guys, but the CO vetoed it. We heard it at the forward bases and camps where we were sitting around waiting for something real to do. The Grom, the Polish Special Forces, were going out and doing jobs. They told us we were lions led by dogs. The Marines were blunter. They'd come back every night and bust on us. How many did y'all get tonight? Oh, that's right. Y'all didn't go out. Ball busters. But I couldn't blame them. I thought our headshed was a bunch of pussies. We had started training to take down Mukarrayin Dam northeast of Baghdad. The dam was important not only because it provided hydroelectric power, but because if it were allowed to flood, it could have slowed military forces attacking Iraqis in the area. But the mission was continually postponed, and finally given to SEAL Team 5 when they rotated into the Gulf toward the end of our stay. The mission, which followed our basic plan, was a success. There were many things we could have done. How much of an impact on the war they would have had, I have no idea. We certainly could have saved a few lives here and there, maybe shortened some conflicts by a day or more. Instead, we were told to get ready to go home. Our deployment was over. I sat back at base for a couple of weeks with nothing to do. I felt like a little fucking coward, playing video games and waiting to ship out. I was pretty pissed. In fact, I was so mad I wanted to leave the Navy and give up being a SEAL. 5. Sniper. Taya. The first time Chris came home, he was really disgusted with everything. With America, especially. In the car on the way back to our house, we listened to the radio. People weren't talking about the war. Life went on as if nothing was happening in Iraq. People are talking about bullshit, he said. We're fighting for the country and no one gives a shit. He'd been really disappointed when the war began. He was back in Kuwait and had seen something on television that was negative about the troops. He called and said, "You know what? If that's what they think, fuck them. I'm out here ready to give my life and they're doing bullshit." I had to tell him there were a lot of people who cared, not just for the troops in general, but for him. He had me, he had friends in San Diego and Texas and family. But the adjustment to being home was hard. He'd wake up punching. He'd always been jumpy, but now, when I got up in the middle of the night, I'd stop and say his name before I got back into bed. I had to wake him up before coming back to bed to ensure I wasn't hit with his basic reflex. One time I woke up to him grabbing my arm with both of his hands. One hand was on the forearm and one just slightly above the elbow. He was sound asleep and appeared to be ready to snap my arm in half. I stayed as still as possible and kept repeating his name, getting louder each time so as not to startle him, but also to stop the impending damage to my arm. Finally, he woke and let go. Slowly, we settled into some new habits and adjusted. Scares. I didn't quit the SEALs. I might have if my contract hadn't still had a lot of time to run. Maybe I would have gone to the Marines, but it wasn't an option. I had some reason for hope. When you come home and the team returns from a deployment, there's a reshuffling at the top and you get new leadership. There was always a chance our new headshed would be better. I talked to Taya and told her how pissed off I was. Of course, she had a different perspective. She was just happy that I was alive and home in one piece. Meanwhile, the brass got huge promotions and congratulations for their part in the war. They got the glory. Bullshit glory. Bullshit glory for a war they didn't fight and the cowardly stance they took. Their cowardice ended lives we could have saved if they would have let us do our jobs. But that's politics for you. A bunch of game players sitting around congratulating each other in safety while real lives are getting screwed up. Every time I returned home from deployment, starting then, I wouldn't leave the house for about a week. I'd just stay there. Generally, we'd get about a month off after unloading and sorting our gear and stuff. That first week, I'd always stay home with Taya and keep to myself. Only after that would I start seeing family and friends. I didn't have flashbacks of battle or anything dramatic like that. I just needed to be alone. I do remember once after the first deployment when I had something like a flashback, though it only lasted a few seconds. I was sitting in the room we used as an office in our house in Alpine near San Diego. We had a burglar alarm system, and for some reason, Taya set it off accidentally when she came home. It scared the ever-living shit out of me. I just immediately went right back to Kuwait. I dove under the desk. I thought it was a Scud attack. We laugh about it now, but for those few seconds, I was truly scared. More scared than I had ever been in Kuwait when the Scuds actually did fly over. I've had more fun with burglar alarms than I can recount. One day I woke up after Taya had left for work. As soon as I got out of bed, the alarm went off. This one was in voice mode, so it alerted me with a computerized voice. Intruder alert! Intruder in the house! Intruder alert! I grabbed my pistol and went to confront the criminal. No son of a bitch was breaking into my house and living to tell about it. Intruder, living room. I carefully proceeded to the living room and used all of my SEAL skills to clear the living room. Vacant. Smart criminal. I moved down the hall. Intruder, kitchen. The kitchen was also clear. The son of a bitch was running from me. Intruder, hall. Motherfucker. I can't tell you how long it took before I realized I was the intruder. The system was tracking me. Taya had set the alarm to a setting that assumed the house was vacant, turning on the motion detectors. Y'all feel free to laugh. With me, not at me, right? I always seemed more vulnerable at home. After every deployment, something would happen to me, usually during training. I broke a toe, a finger, all sorts of little injuries. Overseas on deployment, in the war, I seemed invincible. You take off your superhero cape every time you come home from deployment, Taya used to joke. After a while, I figured it was true. My parents had been nervous the entire time I was away. They wanted to see me as soon as I got home, and I think my need to keep to myself at first probably hurt them more than they'll say. When we finally did get together, though, it was a pretty happy day. My dad took my deployment especially hard, outwardly showing his anxiousness a lot more than my mother. It's funny. Sometimes the strongest individuals feel the worst when events are out of their control, and they can't really be there for the people they love. I felt it myself. It was a pattern that would repeat itself every time I went overseas. My mom carried on like the stoic one. My otherwise stoic dad became the family worrier. Schooled. I gave up part of my vacation and came back from leave a week early to go to sniper school. I would have given up much more than that for the chance. Marine snipers have justifiably gotten a lot of attention over the years, and their training program is still regarded as one of the world's best. In fact, SEAL snipers used to be trained there. But we've gone ahead and started our own school, adapting a lot of what the Marines do, but adding a number of things to prepare SEAL snipers for our mission. The SEAL school takes a little more than twice as long to complete because of that. Next to Bud's, sniper training was the hardest school I ever went through. They were constantly messing with our heads. We had late nights and early mornings. We were always running or being stressed in some way. That was a key part of the instruction. Since they can't shoot at you, they put as much pressure on you as they can manage in every other way. From what I've heard, only 50% of the SEALs who take the school make it through. I can believe it. The first classes teach SEALs how to use the computers and cameras that are part of our job. SEAL snipers aren't just shooters. In fact, shooting is only a small part of the job. It's an important, vital part, but it's far from everything. A SEAL sniper is trained to observe. It's a foundation skill. He may find himself out ahead of a main force, tasked to discover everything he can about the enemy. Even if he's assigned to get into position to take out a high-value target, the first thing he has to be able to do is observe the area. He needs to be able to use modern navigational skills and tools like GPS, and at the same time present the information he's gathered. So, that's where we start. The next part of the course, and in a lot of ways the hardest, is stalking. That's the part where most guys fall out. Stalking means sneaking into a position without being seen. Easier said than done. It's moving slowly and carefully to the exact right spot for the mission. It's not patience, or at least that's not all it is. It's professional discipline. I'm not a patient person, but I learned that to succeed as a stalker, I needed to take my time. If I know I'm going to kill someone, I'll wait a day, a week, 2 weeks. Make that, I have waited. I will do whatever it takes. And let's just say there are no bathroom breaks either. For one of the exercises, I had to sneak through a hayfield. I took hours arranging the grass and hay in my ghillie suit. The ghillie suit is made of burlap and is a kind of camouflage base for a sniper on a stalking mission. The suit allows you to add hay or grass or whatever so you can blend in with your surroundings. The burlap adds depth, so it doesn't look like a guy with hay sticking out of your butt as you cross a field. You look like a bush. But the suits are hot and sweaty, and they don't make you invisible. When you come to another piece of terrain, you have to stop and rearrange your camouflage. You have to look like whatever it is you're crossing. I remember one time I was making my way slowly across a field when I heard the distinct rattle of a snake nearby. A rattler had taken a particular liking to the piece of real estate I had to cross. Willing it away didn't work. Not wanting to give away my position to the instructor grading me, I crept slowly to the side, altering my course. Some enemies aren't worth fighting. During the stalking portion of our training, you're not graded on your first shot. You're graded on your second. In other words, once you've fired, can you be seen? Hopefully, no, because not only is there a good possibility you'll have to take more shots, but you have to get out of there, too, and it would be nice to do that alive. It's important to remember that perfect circles do not exist in nature, and that means you have to do what you can to camouflage your scope and rifle barrel. I would take tape and put it over my barrel, then spray paint the tape up to camouflage it further. I'd keep some vegetation in front of my scope as well as my barrel. You don't need to see everything, just your target. For me, stalking was the hardest part of the course. I nearly failed because of a lack of patience. It was only after we mastered stalking that we moved on to shooting. Guns. People ask a lot about weapons, what I used as a sniper, what I learned on, what I prefer. In the field, I matched the weapon to the job and the situation. At sniper school, I learned the basics of a range of weapons, so I was prepared not only to use them all, but also to choose the right one for the job. I used 4 basic weapons at sniper school. 2 were magazine-fed semi-automatics, the Mark 12, a 5.56 sniper rifle, and the Mark 11, a 7.62 sniper rifle. When I talk about a gun, I often just mention the caliber, so the Mark 12 is the 5.56. Oh, and there's no point in front of the numbers. It's understood. Then there was my 300 Win Mag. That was magazine-fed, but it was bolt-action. Like the other two, it was suppressed, which means that it has a device on the end of the barrel that suppresses muzzle flash and reduces the sound of the bullet as it leaves the gun, much like a muffler on a car. It's not actually a silencer, though some think of it that way. Without getting too technical, the suppressor works by letting gas out of the barrel as the bullet discharges. Generally speaking, there are 2 types, one that attaches to the barrel of the weapon and another that's integrated with the barrel itself. Among the practical effects of the suppressor on a sniper rifle, is that it tends to reduce the amount of kick the shooter experiences. This helps make it more accurate. I also had a 50 caliber, which was not suppressed. Let's talk about each weapon individually. Mark 12. Officially, the United States Navy Mark 12 Special Purpose Rifle. This gun has a 16-inch barrel, but is otherwise the same platform as an M4. It fires a 5.56 by 45 millimeter round from a 30-round magazine. It can also be fitted with a 20-round box. Derived from what became known as the 223 cartridge, and therefore smaller and lighter than most earlier military rounds, the 5.56 is not a preferred bullet to shoot someone with. It can take a few shots to put someone down, especially the drugged-up crazies we were dealing with in Iraq, unless you hit them in the head. And contrary to what you're probably thinking, not all sniper shots, certainly not mine, take the bad guys in the head. Usually, I went for center mass, a nice fat target somewhere in the middle of the body, giving me plenty of room to work with. The gun was super easy to handle, and was virtually interchangeable with the M4, which, though not a sniper weapon, is still a valuable combat tool. As a matter of fact, when I got back to my platoon, I took the lower receiver off my M4 and put it on the upper receiver of my Mark 12. That gave me a collapsible stock and allowed me to go full auto. I see now that some Mark 12s are being equipped with the collapsible stock. On patrol, I like to use a shorter stock. It's quicker to get up to my shoulder and get a bead on somebody. It's also better for working inside and in tight quarters. Another note on my personal configuration, I never used full auto on the rifle. The only time you really want full auto is to keep someone's head down. Spewing bullets doesn't make for an accurate course of fire. But since there might be a circumstance where it would come in handy, I always wanted to have that option in case I needed it. Mark 11. Officially called the Mark 11 Mod 10 Special Purpose Rifle, and also known as the SR-25, this is an extremely versatile weapon. I particularly like the idea of the Mark 11 because I could patrol with it in place of an M4 and still use it as a sniper rifle. It didn't have a collapsible stock, but that was its only drawback. I would tie the suppressor onto my kit, leaving it off during the start of a patrol. If I needed to take a sniper shot, I would put it on. But if I was on the street or moving on foot, I could shoot back right away. It was semi-automatic, so I could get a lot of bullets on a target, and it fired 7.62 by 51 millimeter bullets from a 20-round box. Those had more stopping power than the smaller 5.56 NATO rounds. I could shoot a guy once and put him down. Our rounds were match-grade ammo bought from Black Hills, which makes probably the best sniper ammo around. The Mark 11 had a bad reputation in the field because it would often jam. We wouldn't have jams that much in training, but overseas was a different story. We eventually figured out that something to do with the dust cover on the rifle was causing a double feed. We solved a lot of the problem by leaving the dust cover down. There were other issues with the weapon, however, and personally it was never one of my favorites. 300 Win Mag. The 300 is in another class entirely. As I'm sure many listeners know, 300 Win Mag refers to the bullet the rifle fires, the 300 Winchester Magnum round, 7.62 by 67 millimeters. It's an excellent all-around cartridge whose performance allows for superb accuracy as well as stopping power. Other services fire the round from different or slightly different guns. Arguably the most famous is the Army's M24 sniper weapon system, which is based on the Remington 700 rifle. Yes, that is the same rifle civilians can purchase for hunting. In our case, we started out with Macmillan stocks, customized the barrels, and used 700 action. These were nice rifles. In my third platoon, the one that went to Ramadi, we got all new 300s. These used Accuracy International stocks with a brand new barrel in action. The AI version had a shorter barrel with a folding stock. They were badass. The 300 is a little heavier gun by design. It shoots like a laser. Anything from 1,000 yards and out, you're just plain nailing it. And on closer targets, you don't have to worry about too much correction for your come-ups. You can dial in your 500-yard dope and still hit a target from 100 to 700 yards without worrying too much about making minute adjustments. I used a 300 Win Mag for most of my kills. 50 caliber. The 50 is huge, extremely heavy, and I just don't like it. I never used one in Iraq. There's a certain amount of hype and even romance for these weapons, which shoot a 12.7 by 99 millimeter round. There are a few different specific rifles and variations in service with the U.S. military and other armies around the world. You've probably heard of the Barrett M82 or the M107, developed by Barrett Firearms Manufacturing. They have enormous ranges, and in the right application are certainly good weapons. I just didn't like them all that much. The 150 I do like is the Accuracy International model, which has a more compact, collapsible stock and a little more accuracy. It wasn't available to us at the time. Everyone says that the 50 is a perfect anti-vehicle gun, but the truth is that if you shoot the 50 through a vehicle's engine block, you're not actually going to stop the vehicle. Not right away. The fluid will leak out and eventually it'll stop moving, but it's not instant by any means. A 338 and even a 300 will do the same thing. Nope, the best way to stop a vehicle is to shoot the driver, and that you can do with a number of weapons. 338. We didn't have 338s in training. We started getting them later on during the war. Again, the name refers to the bullet. There are a number of different manufacturers, including Macmillan and Accuracy International. The bullet shoots farther and flatter than a 50 caliber, weighs less, costs less, and will do just as much damage. They are awesome weapons. I used a 338 on my last deployment. I would have used it more if I'd had it. The only drawback for me was my model's lack of a suppressor. When you're shooting inside a building, the concussion is strong enough that it's a pain, literally. My ears would hurt after a few shots. Since I'm talking about guns, I'll mention that my current favorites are the weapon systems made by GA Precision, a very small company started in 1999 by George Gardner. He and his staff pay close attention to every detail, and his weapons are just awesome. I didn't get a chance to try one until I got out of the service, but now they're what I use. Scopes are an important part of the weapon system. Overseas, I used a 32 power scope. The powers on a scope refer to the magnification of the focal length. Without getting too technical, the higher the power, the better a shooter can see at a distance. But there are trade-offs, dependent on the situation and the scope. Scopes should be chosen with a mind toward the situation they'll be used in. To give an obvious example, a 32-power scope would be wildly inappropriate on a shotgun. Additionally, depending on the circumstances, I had an infrared and visible red laser, as well as night vision for the scope. As a SEAL, I used Night Force scopes. They have very clear glass, and they're extremely durable under terrible conditions. They always held their zero for me. On deployments, I used a Leica rangefinder to determine how far I was from a target. Most of the stocks on my guns used adjustable cheek pieces, sometimes called a comb. Technically, the comb is the top piece of the stock, but the terms are sometimes interchanged. The extension let me keep my eye in position when sighting through the scope. On older weapons, we would adapt a piece of hard-packed foam and raise the stock to the right height. As scope rings have gotten larger and more varied in size, the ability to change the stock height has become more important. I use a 2-pound trigger on my rifles. That's a fairly light pull. I want the trigger to surprise me every time. I don't want to jerk the gun as I fire. I want no resistance. Get set, get ready, put my finger, and gently start squeezing, and it goes off. As a hunter, I knew how to shoot. How to make the bullet go from point A to point B. Sniper school taught me the science behind it all. One of the more interesting facts is that the barrel of a rifle cannot touch any part of the stock. They need to be free-floating to increase accuracy. The barrel will float in the stock due to the way the stock is cut out. It attaches only to the main body of the rifle. When you shoot a round, a vibration comes through the barrel, known as barrel whip. Anything touching the barrel will affect that vibration and, in turn, affect the accuracy. Then, there are things like the Coriolis effect, which has to do with the rotation of the earth and the effect it has on a rifle bullet. This comes into play only at extremely long distances. You live all of this technical data in sniper school. You learn about how far to lead someone when they're moving, if they're walking, if they're running, depending on the distance. You keep doing it until the understanding is embedded not just in your brain, but in your arms and hands and fingers. In most shooting situations, I adjust for elevation, but not for windage. Simply put, adjusting for elevation means adjusting my aim to compensate for the drop of my bullet over the distance it travels. Windage means compensating for the effect of the wind. The wind is constantly changing, so about the time I adjust for wind, the wind changes. Elevation is a different story, though if you're in a combat situation, a lot of times you don't have the luxury of making a fine adjustment. You have to shoot or be shot. Tested. I was not the best sniper in my class. In fact, I failed the practice test. That meant potentially washing out of the class. Unlike the Marines, in the field, we don't work with spotters. The SEAL philosophy is basically, if you have a fellow warrior with you, he ought to be shooting, not watching. That said, we did use spotters in training. After I failed the test, the instructor went through everything with me and my spotter trying to figure out where I'd gone wrong. My scope was perfect, my dope was set, there was nothing mechanically wrong with the rifle. Suddenly he looked up at me. "Dip," he said, more a statement than a question. "Oh." I hadn't put any chewing tobacco in my mouth during the test. It was the only thing I'd done differently, and it turned out to be the key. I passed the exam with flying colors and a wad of tobacco in my cheek. Snipers, as a breed, tend to be superstitious. We're like baseball players with our little rituals and must-dos. Watch a baseball game and you'll see a batter always does the same thing as he steps to the plate. He'll make the sign of the cross, kick the dirt, wave the bat. Snipers are the same way. During my training and afterward, I kept my guns a certain way, wore the same clothes, had everything arranged precisely the same. It's all a matter of controlling everything on my mind. I know the gun is going to do its job. I need to make sure I do mine. There's a lot more to being a SEAL sniper than shooting. As training progressed, I was taught to study the terrain and the surroundings. I learned to see things with the sniper's eye. If I were trying to kill me, where would I set up? That roof. I could take the whole squad from there. Once I identified those spots, I'd spend more time looking at them. I had excellent vision going into the course, but it wasn't so much seeing as learning to perceive, knowing what sort of movement should get your attention, discerning subtle shapes that can tip off a waiting ambush. I had to practice to stay sharp. Observation is hard work. I'd go outside and just train myself to spot things in the distance. I always tried to hone my craft, even on leave. On a ranch in Texas, you see animals, birds. You learn to look in the distance and spot movement, shapes, little inconsistencies in the landscape. For a while, it seemed like everything I did helped train me, even video games. I had a little handheld Mahjong game that a friend of mine had given us as a wedding present. I don't know if it was exactly appropriate as a wedding present. It's a handheld one-person game, but as a training tool, it was invaluable. In Mahjong, you scan different tiles, looking for matches. I would play timed sessions against the computer, working to sharpen my observation skills. I said it before, and I'll keep saying it. I'm not the best shot in the world. There were plenty of guys better than me, even in that class. I only graduated about middle of the pack. As it happened, the guy who was the honor man, or best in our class, was part of our platoon. He never had as many kills as I did, though, at least partly because he was sent to the Philippines for a few months while I spent my time in Iraq. You need skill to be a sniper, but you also need opportunity and luck. Beaten by dolphins, eaten by sharks. After spending the entire summer at sniper school, I returned to my platoon and got busy with the rest of our workup, going through the different training sessions as we prepared to deploy in a year. As usual, I had some of my hardest times in the water. Everyone gets all warm and fuzzy about marine animals. but I've had close and personal encounters that were anything but. While the Navy was testing a program using dolphins for harbor defense, they used us as targets, in a few cases without warning. The dolphins would come out and beat the shit out of us. They were trained to hit in the sides, and they could crack ribs, and if you hadn't been warned in advance of the exercise, you didn't know what was going on. Your first reaction, or at least mine, was to think you were being attacked by sharks. One time we were out and the dolphins were taking it to us. Getting beaten bad, I headed toward shore to dodge the bastards. Spotting some piers, I ducked underneath. I knew they wouldn't follow me. Safe. All of a sudden, something clamped hard on my leg. Hard. It was a sea lion. They were being trained to guard the piers. I went back out into open water. I'd rather be beaten by a dolphin than eaten by a sea lion. But sharks were, by far, the worst. One evening, we were supposed to swim across the bay off San Diego in the dark and plant a limpet mine on a particular ship. Simple, standard SEAL operation. Not every SEAL hates the water like I do. In fact, a lot of them like it so much they'll swim around and play tricks on the others in the exercise. You might have a guy plant his mine, then sink to the bottom and wait for the next guy to come over with his. There's usually enough light from above that the second diver is silhouetted and easy to see. So when the victim, I mean diver, comes to plant his mine, the first diver comes up, grabs his fin, and jerks it. That scares the shit out of the second diver. Usually he thinks there's a shark in the water and screws up the rest of the exercise. And his gear may need a special cleaning. On this particular day, I was beneath the ship and had just planted my mine when something grabbed my fin. Shark! Then I put my heart back in my chest, remembering all the stories and warnings about my brethren SEALs. Just one of the guys messing with my head, I told myself. I turned around to flip him off and found myself giving the finger to a shark who'd taken a particular liking to my flipper. He had it in his jaw. He wasn't a huge shark, but what he lacked in size he made up for in pure orneriness. I grabbed my knife and cut off my fin. No sense keeping it now that it was all chewed up, right? While he was munching on what remained of it, I swam up to the surface and flagged down the security boat. I grabbed onto the side and explained that they were taking me in right now because there was a shark out here and he was one hungry mother. During another training exercise, this one was before my first deployment, four of us were inserted on the California coast from a submarine. We came ashore in two Zodiacs, built a hide, and did some reconnaissance. When the time came, we all got in our Zodiacs and headed back out to meet the sub and go home. Unfortunately, my officer had given the submarine the wrong grid coordinates for the rendezvous. In fact, they were so far off that there was an island between us and the sub. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. We just circled around, trying to make radio comms with a vessel that was too far away to hear us. At some point, either our radio got wet or the battery drained, and all hope of connection was lost. We spent just about the entire night out on the water in the Zodiacs. Finally, as dawn approached, our fuel was nearly gone. My raft was starting to go flat. We all decided we'd just go back ashore and wait. At least we would get some sleep. As we were coming in, a sea lion swam up, all friendly-like. Being from Texas, I had never really had much of a chance to look at sea lions, so naturally I was curious and started watching this one. He was a pretty interesting, if ugly, critter. All of the sudden, splop, he disappeared below the surface. The next thing I knew, he and we were surrounded by large, pointy fins. Apparently, a number of sharks had decided to make breakfast to him. Sea lions are big, but there were way too many sharks to be satisfied with just him. They started circling closer and closer to the sides of my raft, which looked increasingly thin and perilously close to the water. I glanced toward shore. It was very far off. Holy shit, I thought. I'm gonna get eaten. My companion in the raft was a rather round fellow, at least for a seal. If we go down, I warned him, I'm shooting you. You'll be something for the sharks to munch on while I swim to shore. He just cursed at me. I think he thought I was kidding. I wasn't. Tats. We did finally make shore without getting eaten, but meanwhile the entire Navy was looking for us. The news media started carrying the story, 4 SEALs lost at sea. Not exactly what we wanted to be famous for. It took a while, but a patrol plane finally spotted us, and a Mark V was dispatched to pick us up. The commander of the assault boat took care of us and got us home. That was one of the few times when I was really glad to get aboard a boat or ship. Generally, when I've been out at sea, I've been bored. Worrying about being assigned to sea duty was a big motivator during BUDS. Submarines are the worst. Even the largest feel cramped. The last time I was aboard one, we weren't even allowed to work out. The gym was located on the other side of the nuclear reactor from our quarters, and we weren't authorized to pass through the reactor area to get there. Aircraft carriers are a hell of a lot larger, but they can be just as boring. At least they have lounges where you can play video games and there are no restrictions on getting to the gym to blow off steam. In fact, on one occasion, we were specifically requested to go to the gym by the CO. We were on the Kitty Hawk when they were having a problem with gangs. Apparently some punk sailors who were gang members were causing quite a discipline problem aboard ship. The CO of the boat pulled us over and told us when the gang used the gym. So we went down to work out, locked the door behind us, and fixed the gang problem. During this workup, I missed a dive session because I got sick. It was as if a light went off in my head. From that point on, just about every time diving turned up on our practice schedule, I came down with a very bad disease, or I found a sniper training trip that just had to be taken at that point. The rest of the guys teased me that I had better ninja smoke than anybody. And who am I to argue? I also got my first tattoo around this time. I wanted to honor the SEALs, and yet I didn't feel as if I'd earned a trident tattoo. The official SEAL emblem had an eagle perched in an overwatch position on a trident that forms the crossbars of an anchor. A flintlock pistol sits in front of it. The insignia is known as the trident, or, unofficially, a Budweiser, the reference being to Buds or the beer, depending on who you ask. So instead I got a frog bone, a tattoo that looks like a frog skeleton. This, too, is a traditional SEAL and UDT symbol, in this case honoring our dead comrades. I have the tattoo on my back peeking over my shoulder, as if those who came before me were looking after me, offering some protection. Birth. Besides being a SEAL, I was also a husband, and after I came home, Taya and I decided to try and start a family. Things went pretty well. She got pregnant about the first time we kissed without protection, and her pregnancy was near perfect. It was the childbirth that got complicated. For some reason, my wife had a problem with a low platelet count. Unfortunately, the problem wasn't discovered until too late, and because of that, she couldn't get an epidural or other painkiller when it came time to give birth. So she had to give birth naturally, without any training or preparation. Our son was 8 pounds. Not a particularly small kid. You learn a lot about a woman when she's under duress. I got bitched to high heaven. She claimed she didn't, but I know better. And who are you going to believe, a SEAL or a SEAL's wife? Taya was in labor for 16 hours. Toward the end, they decided they could give her laughing gas to ease the pain. But before they did, they warned me of everything that could happen to my son, no matter how distant the possibility. I didn't feel I had much of a choice. She was in tremendous pain. She needed relief. I told them to go ahead, though in the back of my mind I was worried that my boy would come out messed up. Then the doctor told me my son was so big he couldn't quite squeeze through the birth canal. They wanted to put a suction thing on his head to help him get out. Meanwhile, Taya was passing out cold between contractions. Okay, I said, not really understanding. The doctor looked at me. He may come out like a conehead. Oh, great, I thought. My child is not only going to be fucked up from the gas, but he's going to be a conehead. God damn it, just get him out of there, I told him. You're killing my wife. Do it. My boy came out just fine. But I have to say, I was a case the whole time. It was the most hopeless feeling in the world, seeing my wife in excruciating pain without anything I could do. I was a hell of a lot more nervous watching her give birth than I ever was in combat. Taya. It was a very emotional time, with tremendous highs and lows. Both of our families were in town for the birth. We were all very happy, and yet, at the same time, we knew Chris would be leaving soon for Iraq. That part sucked. Chris had trouble handling the baby's crying at first, and that stressed me out as well. You can handle war, but you can't handle a few days of crying? Most people don't deal too well with that. Chris certainly wasn't one of the exceptions. I knew that taking care of our son was all going to be on me for the next several months while he was away. More importantly, I knew that all the newness and magic was also going to be with me. I was nervous about how I would handle it, and sad that all the memories of our beautiful son would be mine alone, as opposed to shared memories we could look back on together. At the same time, I was angry he was leaving, and terrified he wouldn't make it back. I also loved him like crazy. NAV School. Besides sniper school, I had been volunteered for NAV school by my chief. I went reluctantly. Navigating is an important skill in combat. Without a navigator, you don't know how to get to the battle, let alone how to get away when you're done. In a DA, direct action scenario, the navigator figures out the best way to the target, comes up with alternatives, and guides the fire team to safety when you're done. The problem is, SEAL navigators often don't get a chance to actually fight in the DA they navigate to. The way we set things up, the navigator is usually assigned to stay in the vehicle while the rest of the unit breaks into the house or whatever. That's so he can be ready in case we need to get out fast. Sitting in the passenger seat, plugging numbers into a computer was not exactly where I wanted to be. But my chief wanted someone he could count on, planning the routes. And when your chief asks you to do something, you do it. I spent the whole first week of NAV school frowning at a desk in front of a tough book laptop computer, learning the computer's functions, how to hook up to a GPS and manipulate the satellite imagery and maps. I also learned how to take the images and paste them onto PowerPoint for briefings and the like. Yes, even SEALs use PowerPoint. The second week was a little more interesting. We drove around the city, we were in San Diego, plotting and following different routes. I'm not pretending it was cool, though. Important, yes, but not very exciting. As it happened, though, it was my skills as a navigator that got me to Iraq ahead of everyone else. 6. Dealing Death. Back to war. Toward the end of our workup, we found out that they were standing up a new unit in Baghdad to do direct action raids on suspected terrorists and resistance leaders. The unit was being run by the GROM, the Polish Special Operations Unit. While the Poles would handle most of the heavy lifting, they needed some supplements, namely snipers and navigators. And so, in September 2004, I was pulled from my platoon and sent to Iraq to help the GROM as a navigator. The rest of the platoon was due to come overseas the following month. I'd meet them there. I felt bad about leaving Taya. She was still healing from the birth, but at the same time, I felt my duty as a SEAL was more important. I wanted to get back into action. I wanted to go to war. At that point, while I loved my son, I hadn't yet bonded with him. I was never one of those dads who liked to feel my wife's belly when the baby was kicking. I tend to need to know someone well, even kin, before that part of me grows. That changed over time, but at that point I still hadn't experienced the real depth of what being a father is all about. Generally, when SEALs go out for a deployment or come back, we do so very quietly. That's the nature of special operations. There are usually few people around, except for immediate families, sometimes not even them. In this case, because of when I was heading out, it happened that I passed a small group of protesters demonstrating against the war. They had signs about baby killers and murderers and whatever, protesting the troops who were going over to fight. They were protesting the wrong people. We didn't vote in Congress. We didn't vote to go to war. I signed up to protect this country. I do not choose the wars. It happens that I love to fight, but I do not choose which battles I go to. Y'all send me to them. I had to wonder why these people weren't protesting at their congressional offices or in Washington. Protesting the people who were ordered to protect them. Let's just say it put a bad taste in my mouth. I realize not everybody felt that way. I did see signs on some homes supporting the troops, saying, "We love you," and that sort of thing. And there were plenty of tearful and respectful send-offs and homecomings, some even on TV. But it was the ignorant protesters I remembered, years and years later. And for the record, it doesn't bother me that SEALs don't have big send-offs or fancy homecomings. We are the silent professionals. We're covert operators, and inviting the media to the airport is not in the program. Still, it's nice to be thanked every so often for doing our job. Iraq. A lot had happened in Iraq since I left in the spring of 2003. The country had been liberated from Saddam Hussein and his army with the fall of Baghdad on April 9 of that year. But a variety of terrorist forces either continued or began fighting after Saddam was deposed. They fought both other Iraqis and the U.S. forces who were trying to help the country regain stability. Some were former members of Saddam's army and members of the Ba'athist party that Saddam had headed. They were Fedayeen, members of a paramilitary resistance group the dictator had organized before the war. There were small, poorly organized groups of Iraqi guerrillas, who were also called Fedayeen, though technically they weren't connected with Saddam's organization. Though nearly all were Muslim, nationalism rather than religion tended to be their primary motive and organizing principle. Then there were the groups organized primarily around religious beliefs. These identified themselves as Mujahideen, which basically means people on jihad, or murderers in the name of God. They were dedicated to killing Americans and Muslims who didn't believe in the brand of Islam that they believed in. There was also Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a mostly foreign group that saw the war as an opportunity to kill Americans. They were radical Sunni Muslims with an allegiance to Osama bin Laden, the terrorist leader who needs no introduction, and whom SEALs hunted down and gave a fitting send-off in 2011. There were also Iranians and their Republican Guard, who fought, sometimes directly, though usually through proxies, to both kill Americans and to gain power in Iraqi politics. I'm sure there were a hell of a lot of others in what came to be known to the media as the insurgency. They were all the enemy. I never worried too much about who exactly it was who was pointing a gun at me or planting an IED. The fact that they wanted to kill me was all I needed to know. Saddam was captured in December of 2003. In 2004, the U.S. formally turned over authority to the interim government, giving control of the country back to the Iraqis, at least in theory. But the insurgency grew tremendously that same year. A number of battles in the spring were as fierce as those waged during the initial invasion. In Baghdad, a hardline Shiite cleric named Muqtada al-Sadr organized an army of fanatical followers and urged them to attack Americans. Sadr was especially strong in a part of Baghdad known as Sadr City, a slum named after his father, Mohammed Sadek al-Sadr, a grand ayatollah and an opponent of Saddam's regime during the 1990s. An extremely poor area, even by Iraqi standards, Sadr City was packed with radical Shiites. Said to be about half the size of Manhattan in area, Sadr City was located northeast of Baghdad's Green Zone, on the far side of Army Canal and Imam Ali Street. A lot of the places where regular Iraqis live, even if they are considered middle class, look like slums to an American. Decades of Saddam's rule made what could have been a fairly rich country due to its oil reserves into a very poor one. Even in the better parts of the cities, a lot of the streets aren't paved and the buildings are pretty run down. Sadr City is truly a slum, even for Iraq. It began as a public housing area for the poor, and by the time of the war it had become a refuge for Shiites, who were discriminated against by Saddam's Sunni-dominated government. After the war started, even more Shiites moved into the area. I've seen reports estimating that more than 2 million people lived within its roughly 8 square miles. Laid out in a grid pattern, the streets are 50 or 100 yards long. Most areas have densely packed 2- and 3-story buildings. The workmanship on the buildings I saw was terrible. Even on the fanciest buildings, the decorative lines didn't match up from one side to the other. Many of the streets are open sewers with waste everywhere. Muqtada al-Sadr launched an offensive against American forces in the spring of 2004. His force managed to kill a number of American troops and a far greater number of Iraqis before the fanatical cleric declared a ceasefire in June. In military terms, his offensive failed, but the insurgents remained strong in Sadr City. Meanwhile, most Sunni insurgents took a hold of al-Anbar province, a large sector of the country to the west of Baghdad. They were particularly strong in the cities there, including Ramadi and Fallujah. That spring was the period when Americans were shocked by the images of 4 contractors, their bodies desecrated, hanging from a bridge in Fallujah. It was a sign of worse to come. The Marines moved into the city soon afterward, but their operations were called off after heavy fighting. It's been estimated that at that point they controlled some 25% of the city. As part of the pullout, an Iraqi force came into the city to take control. In theory, they were supposed to keep insurgents out. The reality was very different. By that fall, pretty much the only people who lived in Fallujah were insurgents. It was even more dangerous for Americans than it had been in the spring. When I left for Iraq in September of 2004, my unit had begun training to join a new operation to secure Fallujah once and for all. But I went to work with the Poles in Baghdad instead. With the Grom. Kyle, you will come. The Polish NCO doing the briefing stroked his bushy beard as he pointed at me. I didn't understand much Polish, and he didn't speak very good English, but what he was saying seemed pretty clear. They wanted me to go in the house with them during the operation. Fuck yeah, I said. He smiled. Some expressions are universal. After a week on the job, I had been promoted from navigator to a member of the assault team. I couldn't be happier. I still had to navigate. My job was to figure out a safe route to and from the target house. While the insurgents were active in the Baghdad area, the fighting had slowed down and there wasn't yet the huge threat of IEDs and ambushes that you saw elsewhere. Still, that could change in an instant, and I was careful plotting my routes. We got into our Hummers and set out. I had the front seat next to the driver. I'd learned enough Polish to give directions. Prawo kole, right turn, and guide him through the streets. The computer was on my lap. To my right was a swing arm for a machine gun. We'd taken the Hummer's doors off to make it easier to get in and out and fire. Besides the mounts on my side and in the back, we had a 50 and a turret at the back. We reached the target and hauled ass out of the truck. I was psyched to finally get back into battle. The Poles put me about 6th or 7th in the line to go in. That was a bit disappointing. That far back in the train, you're unlikely to get any action. But I wasn't about to bitch. The Grom hit houses essentially the way SEALs do. There are little variations here and there, the way they come around corners, for example, and the way they cover buddies during an operation. But for the most part, it's all violence of action. Surprise the target, hit